This is part 4 of the series Uranium Mining in Australia by Peter Peddles from the program The Power and the Passion.
Uranium mining may not be a viable industry much longer. Overseas, many millions of dollars are being paid out to uranium mine workers to compensate them for the health effects, mainly cancers, just like our government pays currently many millions of dollars to those affected by the mining and use of asbestos. Another indicator of the hazards involved is that insurance policies generally exclude damages due to radiation. Nor are governments very willing to accept the responsibility for their actions. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair is refusing to award compensation to veterans of nuclear test explosions for the illness they have suffered, despite Labour's support for their cause while in opposition. A new study, Chromosomal Aberrations with Namibian Uranium Mine Workers in Zaire, 1995, indicates the extent of the genetic damage caused by radiation exposure. The highest dose of those workers was only 5 millisieverts, which compares with 20 millisieverts and 50 millisieverts permitted in Australia, far beyond the known increase in birth defects and stillbirths. Much of this genetic damage will be passed on from generation to generation to leave a permanent mark on humanity. However, the study may indicate some new avenues to prove health damages from radiation exposure. This might be an incentive for the government and the uranium industry to adequately care for those to be exposed to radiation from the tailings, including those to be exposed after the mine's operation. The decommissioning and clean-up costs for uranium-producing projects in Australia is currently estimated to be some 70 cents per pound of uranium produced. However, a different approach is shaping up, with Sweden spending some $50 per pound of uranium. It can't be expected that the public will again accept arrangements similar to those for the asbestos mining companies. As Peter Jelinek Fink, scientific secretary of a previous conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said, "We are only one accident away from being dead. Do not misunderstand, he is not concerned about human life or his own life, but the nuclear industry's life."
So why the hell is it that we don't put air, water, and soil as the absolute bottom line? Whatever you're going to do, you don't mess with the air, water, and soil, because that's what gives us life.
I enjoy building a reactor in this country, but will be reactors that can operate at very high temperature without any fuel failure. That under no conditions can you have a core meltdown. Under no conditions can you release radiation to the environment.
That the proponents of nuclear energy haven't been able to put up solutions to the intractable problems which are there.
If we sit down unemotionally and look at nuclear power, it is a safe, clean form of energy.
An Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, is primarily called for in order to look after the environment. But frequently, the EIS is twisted in such a way as to support the industry at the cost of the environment. In the case of both the Jabiluka proposal and the Olympic Dam expansion, the EIS process failed in all stages. An environmental impact statement is meant to explain the environmental problems of a project and then to detail the proponent's concepts of how to deal with the problems. The EIS should demonstrate whether and how environmental concerns are addressed. The environmental impact statement is to show that the project is ecologically sustainable, that there is a balance between economy, environment, and the welfare of the people. But in the case of uranium mining, some of the environmental impacts are so severe and unavoidable that their explanation and discussion would make uranium mining outright unacceptable. How did the proponents of the Jabiluka mine and the Olympic Dam expansion project deal with this dilemma? They simply omitted the considerations of those impacts. In particular, they did not even mention that 80% of the radiation of the uranium ore remains in the tailings, that there is a millionfold increased radiation hazard from the tailings compared to the original ore due to the fine milling, that the small particle sizes of the tailings allow the tailings to become widely dispersed into the environment via wind and water, to become airborne and inhaled, or to enter the food chain. There is no discussion of the long-term consequences of the tailings deposits, the consequent emissions of the radioactive gas radon, the effects of the residual uranium content of the tailings, the costs of containing many millions of tons of powdery tailings for millions of years, the limitations of this task, and the devastating consequences for the Australians of the future, and the past failures of tailings management, which show unwillingness and incapability to deal with the problems, even in the very short term. Unfortunately, the environmental impact statements on behalf of the uranium mining industry omit the essential information, not only the discussion of those principal environmental problems has been omitted from the EIS, but also many details required for an independent assessment. These include important measurements available exclusively to the company. Even such essential details as the particle size distribution of the tailings and their respective radioactivity, or the residual uranium content of the tailings, have not correctly been specified, if at all. This is all made possible and given greater strength by the exclusivity of the uranium mining industry. Access to the most important information, measurements, and latest findings is denied from the general public. Even access to the mines themselves is denied. The EIS could claim just about anything. In the light of these considerations, the omission of those extremely tragic aspects of the projects leads to daunting suspicions about the credibility of all the other data and statements in the EIS, which cannot be checked independently. Hardly any details are given on radiation measurements, past or proposed. Measurement principles, techniques, instrumentation. Do they ever invite or employ independent consultants, engineers, or baseline studies? The environmental impact statements are compromised by the interests of the proponents and their consultants. The public is limited by its lack of information, its inability to check up on measurements and claims. This leaves the supervising and assessing government authorities as a last hope for an assessment of the environmental impact. Their contribution to the EIS process comes as the Environmental Assessment Report, which is supposed to investigate the environmental impact on the basis of the draft EIS, the public submissions, the supplement to the EIS, and their own research. In the case of the Jabiluka proposal, the Commonwealth Department of the Environment wrote a 141-page Environmental Assessment Report, 1997, with exactly one paragraph, or seven sentences, devoted to the assessment of the long-term tailings hazard. Considering that many millions of future lives are endangered, this issue should have taken up at least half of the report. While those few sentences provide some acknowledgement of the impacts, each and every one of those sentences contains gross distortions and or diminishment of the facts. The very approach in writing those sentences shows the bias of the authors for the mining company and against the lives of the future humans. Where it matters the most, the very purpose of an EIS has been ignored. But it is ultimately the Minister for the Environment who either gives consent to the project under certain conditions or rejects the project outright. The final responsibility rests with the Minister for the Environment, Robert Hill, and the Minister for Resources and Energy, Warwick Parer. After the derailment of the EIS process, up to this stage, a tremendous responsibility rests with those two ministers. The public still had the informal opportunity of writing letters to those ministers, and this has certainly been done. Unfortunately, the ministers appear to have reached their decision a long time ago. Even worse, they appear to be at the source of the derailment of the previous stages of the EIS. The ministers concerned appear to be single-minded in pursuing uranium mining as their Prime Minister had promised. As several ministerial advisers and government scientists indicated, the political will to address the issues was not there. But we all know that in the eyes of the government, economic considerations outweigh any other considerations, including the very survival of our future offspring.
We're sitting on a disaster waiting to happen, and when it does, that's the end of nuclear power and it's the end of uranium mining.
Nuclear power.
The nuclear power. It is a safe, clean form of energy. Australia's uranium industry could double and perhaps double again. His uranium industry could double and perhaps double again.
Olympic Dam uranium mine, just as it's set to massively expand. It will become the biggest uranium mine in the world.
The indenture agreement between the South Australian government and the operators of the Roxby Downs mine prohibits the government from making public certain information, including the results of the environmental monitoring of the project. The government now needs the agreement of the mining company to release such information. The hiding of information about the tailings demonstrates a general dishonesty in government and industry. Dishonesty is a near total blanket over our society, and nearly everybody is aware of this. Dishonesty is required where responsibility is discarded. A general apathy is also required. As long as we don't have bullets whizzing past our ears and bombs going off everywhere around us, we can just sit back and turn on the TV. In contrast, for a responsible society, speaking out the truth becomes a major responsibility for everybody.
Your living room is the factory. The product being manufactured is you.
The International Commission on Radiological Protection, or ICRP, is widely accepted as the authoritative body to analyse the available data on the health effects of radiation, and then to issue binding regulations. These regulations are then expected to become incorporated into the laws and regulations of the various nations. Originally, the ICRP was actually attached to a medical congress, and the members of the commission were mainly radiologists and medical scientists. For these reasons, and probably because of its innocent name, the ICRP is still today credited with a great deal of trust into their motives. During the Second World War, the ICRP meetings ceased. After the war, a certain Lauritsen Taylor, former member of the Manhattan Project and development of the first nuclear bomb, initiated the ICRP anew, according to his liking. The ICRP members were to be chosen by its own members, who were originally largely chosen by him. Accordingly, ICRP members are usually close to the uranium mining industry and various factions of the nuclear establishment. So now the ICRP is undemocratic, unrepresentative, and has no legitimacy whatsoever. The professions represented in the ICRP are rather related to industry than to human health, which they are supposed to protect. The relevant fields of epidemiology, genetics and pathology are underrepresented. The biologist R. Blackett from Dublin points out that scientists criticising the ICRP activities are outcast from the ranks of serious scientists. To differ from the majority opinion is regarded as proof of scientific incompetence. Thus, scientific opinion has been hijacked by the most deadly of industries.
Olympic Dam uranium mine, just as it's set to massively expand. It will become the biggest uranium mine in the world because Australian uranium goes all around the world.
It's a medical catastrophe.
Australia's uranium industry could double and perhaps double again. Double and perhaps double again.
Confronted with a technology which expands into ever more risky dimensions, the only society capable of handling such a challenge would have to be based on truth and a caring attitude. Some 8 years ago, a nuclear consultant with international experience told a friend of mine that Australia has good regulations, obviously by ICRP standards, for radiological protection, but supervision was on a third world standard. Good regulations without adequate supervision are useless, except if some concerned citizens go to court. However, this last loophole for humanity is to be closed as well. Now the Australian standards do not even match the ICRP recommendations. The Australian recommendations for the implementation of the new 1990 outdated ICRP dose limits have watered down those limits even further. ICRP 60 recommendations for workers recommends a 5-year cumulative dose limit of up to 100 millisievert. The Australian recommendations provide for exceptions of up to 250 millisieverts. Australia is one of the first, if not the first, country to provide a third world template for no worries regulations. Despite this, at a recent Senate Select Committee hearing, from a representative from ARL and ANSTO, that they declared that Australian regulations were the top of the world. I assume that this means top of the world for making greater profits. The current environmental supervision of uranium mining and milling in Australia is totally inadequate. Naturally, there is a limitation in the case of uranium mining and milling because the adequate supervision of something that should never happen is mutually exclusive. It's just like adequate supervision of genocide. With the uranium mining industry, the genocide is obscured with the intervening time factor, like a slow-acting lethal poison in the municipal water supply. The perpetrators are guilty of future genocide, or should I call it of future genocide, or should I call it futurecide?
Gives us a taste.
Nuclear power
is that the proponents of nuclear energy haven't been able to put up solutions to the intractable problems which are there.
We're sitting on a disaster waiting to happen, and when it does, that's the end of nuclear power and it's the end of uranium mining.
Radioactive waste disposal, Australian uranium goes all around the world.
Australia's uranium industry could double and perhaps double again.
You don't do evil things to make money. We are like opium pushers.
The report from the session of the Permanent People's Tribunal on Chernobyl writes about the International Commission of Radiological Protection, the International Atomic Energy Commission, and the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, quote, "This system of agencies is very tightly knit, with many overlapping memberships, It has been effectively isolated from normal channels of occupational and public health. This small group of scientists has full control of policy making and of recognition given to outside research, which may challenge its findings and decisions. All who disagree with the recommendations and policies are labelled either ignorant, emotional, or non-scientific. There is no international forum in which disputes can be resolved, either for scientific questions or for policy decisions. End of quote. The ICRP recommendations provide the best indication of their motives when it comes to the considerations of the rights and the suffering of the human beings of the distant mine. The most tragic atrocity of the ICRP comes to light. In ICRP 46, chapter 7.3, timescales on page 13-14, the ethical aspects of man-made radiation are discussed as vaguely as possible. In a roundabout way, the ICRP offers two options to the governments on how to disregard these future humans. One, to truncate the dose assessment from a time the government can determine, i.e. not to worry about health and lives of those who come after that date. This is the approach the Australian government has chosen. Those humans living in Australia after 1,000 years from now are disposable for the considerations of our mining industry. Or two, to weight handicap the value of future generations to their detriment. For example, a government could choose that the lives of future generations for each successive century into the future have a reduced value, such that after a certain point they no longer have any value at all. For instance, if the people of each successive century reduced in value by 1%, then those to die in 5,000 years from the tailings radiation would then count only half, whereas the lives of those to die after 10,000 years are not to be counted at all. If we were to be told that the lives of our children did not count at all, we would see huge demonstrations and riots all over Australia. But set the non-consideration of our descendants far enough into the future, in Australia's case only 1,000 years, with the approval of a scientific institution, and we yawn and flick channels to a sports channel or a more exciting soap opera. In fact, the whole chapter 7.3 of ICRP 46 has been written in a way to send the reader and the listener to sleep. It is made to be as obscure and as vague as possible, with nice and good-feeling phrases such as "for careful judgment by national authorities" or "is an issue of an ethical and political nature to which there is no simple answer." The simple statement should be "thou shalt not kill," by whatever means, and especially by means likely to result in genocide. However, looking at the regulations of the various governments involved with the nuclear industry, they have understood almost universally, have decided to truncate somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 years without ever having to bear the consequences of their decisions. To discuss such a decision and the implications publicly would make the decision an obviously deliberate one, possibly an act of mass murder, even though it is deemed legal under the present political and legal system. But we mustn't talk too loudly, otherwise we might be charged with sedition.
That the proponents of nuclear energy haven't been able to put up solutions to the intractable problems which are there.
This kind of economic system we've got is a form of brain damage.
The International Commission on Radiological Protection continually drags its feet in regard to dose reduction needed in response to any new data and statistics on radiation effects. Usually the dose limits were reduced only after considerable delay. At the moment, there is already a 10-year delay between the new statistical evidence requiring a lowered workers' dose limit and the ICRP amendment. Even worse, since the last lowering of the dose limit, frowned upon by the mining industry, but forced onto the ICRP by statistical evidence and critical scientists, several of the individual dose conversion factors for the uranium decay chain have been changed, thereby mitigating some of the effects of the dose reduction for the mining industry. The critical values for workers' protection, permissible inhalation of ore dust and tailings dust, have gone up by a factor of about 2 to 10, despite the reduction of the general dose limit. After nearly half a century, the ICRP has developed an extremely complex dose assessment system, which inhibits public scrutiny. Even the national radiation research bodies are currently not able to make exact determinations. This will eventually lead to the so-called computer modelling by consultancy firms, which removes the last bit of transparency and is wide open to fraud. Obviously, third world countries will be completely at the mercy of the multinational mining giants. In the published proceedings on Chernobyl 1, Environmental Health and Human Rights Implications, the Permanent People's Tribunal states, "The tribunal condemns the International Commission for Radiation Protection, the ICRP, whose policy is clearly inspired by the promotion of the nuclear industry, instead of being aimed at the protection of the potential victims. If we had suitable legal protection, our scientists, bureaucrats and politicians would have learnt their lessons after the asbestos affairs, when disinformation, academic silence and manipulation caused a 30-year delay to the mine closures. Instead, we are facing the same difficulties again, this time with uranium mining. The stakes have increased 1,000-fold, or perhaps 1,000,000-fold. There are several government radiation research bodies in Australia. One would assume that their foremost task is to investigate those issues of public interest. However, they obviously prefer to keep the issues quiet, so the industry remains viable. The tremendously destructive potential of our technology, and the tailings issue in particular, challenge us to rethink our ethical and legal framework. This should be addressed in a future vision of the Constitution. Crimes against humanity and the dignity of the human life are well-established legal terms that have been applied to the Nuremberg trials, the Bosnian War Crimes Tribunal, and the trial of Saddam Hussein, but will not be applied to a government which is currently in power, even if their crime in the long term is far more serious. New killer power not only kills and maims today's generation, it will also continue killing and maiming far into the distant future. So, new killer is also future killer. Either in the short term or in the long term, it is almost a certainty that it will annihilate our collective future. Uranium should be left in the ground. Maintaining our affluent lifestyle is not that important that we must sacrifice our future descendants in order to satisfy our greed today.
You listen to part 4 of Uranium Mining in Australia on Peter Peddle's show, The Power and the Passion. Check out nimbimradiomedia.libsyn.com for the whole calendar month. Go to the calendar column and click on the calendar to see all the contributions held on our website. Thank you.